Hello and welcome to another episode of All for Nature. I'm your host, Michelle Bonebreak, and I'm an outdoor educator here at Shaw Nature Reserve. Okay, listeners, welcome to part two of our three-part series all about ecological gardening. If you haven't listened to the first episode in our series, you might want to pause here and go back to give it a listen now. If you have listened to part one, you already know what ecological gardening is and why it's so important. But if you're like me, knowing where to begin designing a native garden is a bit of a mystery. In this episode, Vivian Baus joins us again to help demystify design. And don't forget to stick around afterward for an update on upcoming events at the Nature Reserve. But first, let's dig into design with Ecological Gardening 101, Part 2, Designing a Native Garden. Welcome back, Vivian, and thank you for joining us. So most of our listeners probably remember you from our last episode, but just in case, please reintroduce yourself and tell us about your role here at the Nature Reserve.
Of course. So I'm a horticulturist at Shaw Nature Reserve with a background in ecological restoration. I've had experience in native landscaping, public education, and land management. I joined the restoration crew at Shaw in 2021, and then in 2022, I transitioned to the horticulture team. At the time, most of my free time was dedicated to growing native plants in my own backyard nursery and designing and installing native plants for friends and family. So our horticulture team manages the Whitmire Wildflower Garden, which is the educational display garden that showcases our region's native plants and natural landscapes. In addition to managing this diverse garden, we also get to work on so many other tasks like growing native plants, seed collection, designing new plantings, public education through classes and programs, stuff like that. It's a pretty amazing job, especially considering that I still get to practice my restoration roots while exploring my passions for native plant, horticulture, and public education and outreach.
Nice. Thank you for coming back to help us learn more about ecological gardening. So let me start by saying I think anyone who heard part one of our series has a better understanding of how important it is to consider local wildlife when designing and planning our gardens. And hopefully, we have some listeners ready to roll up their sleeves this spring and dig into starting or maybe expanding their own native garden. But one challenge, and a challenge I know I have faced myself, is knowing where to begin. So I'm glad you're here with us to help us work toward a better understanding of a really big topic. Before we go any further, I just want to make a note for our listeners that while we are discussing gardening and landscaping, and many people associate gardening with having a backyard and lots of space, that isn't necessarily necessary, right?
No backyard necessary. You can create surprisingly diverse habitats in small spaces, like a city yard or even just a balcony using containers. Proper plant selection and intentional design will be key to creating a natural garden that doesn't overwhelm the space or your neighbors.
Awesome. I can't wait to hear more about that. But first, I'd like to touch on a concept I found really interesting when I was preparing for this episode. When we were discussing ideas for this series, I asked you for some resources to learn more, and you sent me a copy of the materials you use in the Native Plant School class you taught on this very subject, which we'll talk about more later. So thank you for that. And as an aside for listeners, we'll include information about these classes in our show notes. But anyway, when reading through these materials, one statement really grabbed my attention, which is this: the foundation of good ecological design is creating a plant community that grows well together to maximize ecosystem function. I really like that. And then you made a suggestion that one way to work toward that goal is to think of recreating the natural communities of our area. Let's start there. What do you mean by that?
So think of the native natural landscapes that surround us at home. You're creating smaller scale copies of those native landscapes by combining plants of similar habitats that work for your selected site. So you'll have more success with this method because the plants are compatible, both above and below ground, so they will not try to outcompete one another. By recreating local natural communities, there's a chance to increase habitat connectivity, which supports a more diverse range of wildlife. Consider other elements of nature in your design, such as green or living mulch, variety of structural layers, all these things that create diversity in habitat, which supports diversity of insects.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is that the same ideas of diversity, compatibility, and connectivity that help strengthen human communities are just as valuable among the communities of the natural world. So when you say habitat connectivity, in my mind, I think of that concept as a patchwork quilt of little habitats that are close enough in distance to allow wildlife to move across that habitat quilt in search of the resources they need for survival. Would that be an accurate description?
Yeah, so exactly. Habitat loss from human expansion has pushed nature into pockets or islands of habitat. And these islands are isolated from each other. So imagine an ocean. The islands are nature and water is human development, like cities, farmland, stuff like that. It can be difficult for many critters to travel between these pockets, which causes all kinds of issues with resource competition and reproduction. We can create habitat in our yard that connects our yard to surrounding land, providing more continuous resources for wildlife. As the native gardening movement gains popularity, we're actively working together as neighbors and communities to reconnect habitat.
So in your ocean analogy, we can think of ourselves as creating more little islands to fill in those gaps of water and give wildlife more places to find what they need to survive. What are some other goals and considerations we should think about when designing our native landscapes or gardens?
So try to support insects throughout their life cycle rather than just making a stopover garden where pollinators only stop in your yard for a quick snack. A garden that is intentionally maintained to provide shelter and also that is planted with a high diversity of native plants that meet the resource requirements of a species, they'll be able to use your yard to reproduce, which is the goal. Food and habitat resource needs vary species to species, which is why it's so important to incorporate a diversity of native plants, especially those species such as the keystone species we discussed in our last episode that provide the most bang for your buck. They host a lot of different species, so planted effectively, they give a real biodiversity boost. Speaking of keystone species, I mentioned monarch butterflies and their host plants, the milkweed, in the previous episode. I want to emphasize that if you wish to support monarch butterflies and really any other species of insect, it's not enough to just plant milkweed. Milkweed supports the caterpillar stage, but to support adult monarchs, it's important to aim for a diverse plant selection with at least one thing flowering every season. I'll come back to this point later when we discuss plant combinations and ideas, but just note that year-round blooms are important for all species. So for example, spring-blooming trees are essential to emerging queen bees, while fall blooms provide the nutrients for insects, especially migratory butterflies, as they prepare to travel.
Oh, those are great points. So we should think about supporting insects throughout their life cycles. That makes sense. It's like adding an extra layer of insurance for the survival of these insects ourselves, rather than hoping someone else in our local habitat quilt will do it for us. What else should we think about?
So consider adding structural layers. These are not only attractive, but they meet the habitat needs of a variety of species. Natural communities are made up of structural layers. Think of the canopy, understory, shrub, grass, tall and short perennials, and ground covers. Another consideration is planting in mass and drifts and repeating species to show intention.
What does that mean to plant? What are masses and drifts?
So what I mean by that is take a single species and plant a lot of it, essentially. And drift, by drifting, that means like you can move that single species throughout the planting. So you could have a huge mass of a single species and kind of have it flow through the planting. So it's kind of more of a naturalistic look to your planting, which is appealing to pollinators and other wildlife. Less is sometimes more. A few masses and repeating species are much more interesting to look at than a messy mix of too many species. Here's some examples. So you can mass and drift sedges amongst woodland flowers underneath a tree for a naturalistic woodland look. Prairie plantings can show intention with masses and repeating design. Grasses such as river oats and beet grain also look excellent planted in mass, which adds beautiful winter interest in a garden as well. This also ties into what I mentioned earlier about stopover habitat. To a pollinator debating if it should use energy to stop in your yard, seeing masses in bloom is way more attractive as it makes hitting up all the closely planted flowers that much easier. Another consideration is selecting your plants. So carefully select plants based on if they'll do well in your site conditions. And then also consider how compatible the plants are. One thing to consider is their growth habit. Do they create like a mounding shape or are they more of a structural vertical shape? This affects how the planting looks and also how the plants compete with each other for resources. You can also incorporate design features such as focal points and hardscapes that will help break up the landscape. Containers, rock borders, fencing, water features, trellises, all these show intention and can tidy up otherwise wild gardens. Focal points can also be plants. A specimen tree, a structural perennial, or grass towering over shorter species are all great examples. Some people have this idea that native plants cannot be harnessed to behave as a traditional landscape plant, but they can be beautiful.
Those are all great points. Thank you. And you know, I think you made a really interesting point about the way an insect is going to judge us by our gardens and what we've planted there. And that if it can use less fuel moving from one bloom to another because the blooms are so close together in a mass or a drift, it makes sense for an insect to decide to stop at a large mass or drift as opposed to sparsely planted flowers. Less distance between blooms equals less energy spent on finding those blooms. And not to apply human characteristics to insects, but I mean, surely they're concerned about fuel mileage and expenditure of energy in the same way we humans are, right? The more energy they expend, the more they have to find to replace it. So now let's say we've got an idea of the look we want. We've considered the insects in our local area, we understand their life cycle needs, and we have some ideas about the structural design that will meet both our needs and the needs of our local wildlife. Now we're ready to start choosing the specific plants we want to incorporate into our design. Where do we start?
So first, you want to get to know your specific site conditions. So this includes how much sunlight each area receives, the soil composition, as well as moisture. So you want to check for changes in topography, where does moisture collect in your yard, stuff like that. And then you want to do some research. You want to research what plants best fit your site conditions. So choose plants that would thrive in your conditions. Do not pick a plant and try to alter the site to make it work. These plantings will fail in the long run. A good example of this is when I first got into native plants, I definitely went crazy and filled my mom's yard with a bunch of prairie plants. There wasn't really any logic behind it. But now these plantings obviously took off and they're way bigger than they should be in her backyard. And she leaves them because she's excited about the pollinators. Shout out to my mom. But, you know, it's just a good thing to do some research before you plant. Another thing is to source your plants and seed locally, which is important for genetic diversity. For myself, I prefer to buy natives only from trusted local nurseries that I know prioritize local ecotypes. I have purchased out of state before, but to me, there's something much more rewarding about being picky and only buying local. Mm-hmm. So whenever you can, try to buy local for genetic diversity. And then finally, whenever possible and when space is limited, incorporate keystone species that provide benefits to many different species. So oaks, willows, asters, and goldenrods are some top choices.
Oh, that's really helpful. So what are some of your favorite species combinations for specific sites or times of year, and why?
So I do have some situation examples. I didn't want to overwhelm listeners, but it's really hard to narrow it down to two plant species for each situation.
Sure.
So here's some examples. If I had a partially sunny corner bed and I wanted to attract songbirds, I would plant coneflowers and fruiting shrubs such as black chokeberry. And then I would leave the seed heads standing for the birds. It's really fun to watch all the birds flit around and land on the seed heads just to eat the seeds. Another example is if I had a partially sunny foundation bed and I wanted to attract bees, I would plant wild hydrangea, downy woodmint, and foxglove beard tongue, plus some ground covers like sedges, heuchera, and pachyra. If I had a low spot in my yard that holds rain, I would plant a rain garden with swamp milkweed, southern blue flag iris, and cardinal flower. A final example is if I had a sunny bed and I wanted to attract butterflies, I would plant blazing stars, smooth aster, and purple coneflowers. Butterflies really love the color purple.
Wow, that's so interesting. So you know, when I step back and I consider everything we've talked about, it's really exciting to think about all the possible combinations. And it reminds me almost of a treasure hunt in reverse. The idea being that we plant the treasures that bring in all this wildlife. And in fact, I could even envision a game or a competition springing up among neighbors or friends to see how many different species they could attract with their plantings. So This is an audio format, and unfortunately, that means we can't show some of our listeners these combinations. But what we can do is we can drop links to guides and websites and the like in our show notes where folks can see for themselves how beautiful landscaping with native plants can be. And of course, right here at Shaw Nature Reserve, we have the Whitmire Wildflower Garden, and I strongly encourage our listeners to come out if they're able and see for themselves a number of these design principles and even the specific plants that we've talked about today. Okay, Vivian, moving beyond the idea of flower beds and the like, one idea that I think is relatively new and intriguing is the idea of replacing lawns of turf grass with lawn alternatives. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so this is a great idea. So the process of replacing lawn is pretty simple. You choose a method to kill the existing vegetation, such as smothering it with cardboard or plastic for about 6 to 8 weeks. This works well for smaller spaces. Once that is done, you can plant directly. And there are so many great design options. You can create a matrix of ground covers, or just keep it simple and mass a single species that only needs mowing 2 times a year, such as buffalo grass or a sedge like Carex pennsylvanica. This mimics lawn without all that maintenance fuss. This is especially a great idea for difficult to mow spots or spots where grass won't grow, such as under the base of a tree.
Wow, what an interesting idea. I know I'd be down for less mowing. And of course, less mowing means less fuel. And I don't think it's a stretch to say most of us have the desire to reduce not just our fuel usage, but the time we spend on lawn maintenance. So now let's say I'm someone who's new to this and I've been using non-native plants for years. When I think about that, I think it might feel overwhelming to replace everything in my garden. What should I do?
So one thing you can do is prioritize adding those keystone species and designing in mass plantings. And if you aren't quite looking to convert your entire yard to native plants, you can still support wildlife while having some non-native species. There's this thing called the 70-30 rule. Researchers found the percentage of native to non-native plants for a yard to adequately support wildlife. And they found that you should aim to have 70% of native species and the other 30% can be non-native. But the caveat to that is no invasive species. Many non-natives are attractive year-round, and they can add certain aesthetic interests that you can't find a suitable native alternative to. Another caveat, as long as we recognize that non-native plants are essentially statues in the garden because they don't provide anything ecologically. So that plant is taking up space that could be more useful. Aim for an eventual goal of 70% native species and 30% non-native species, and that will definitely adequately support wildlife.
Okay, so that seems doable when you break it down that way. So maybe start with a few keystone species and mass plantings. That combination of keystone species and beautiful masses of blooms at once really does seem like it would offer a lot of bang for the buck and also be a valuable strategy if I have limited space. And speaking of limited space, what are some other strategies I can use to incorporate ecological gardening into my space if my space is limited?
Yeah, so the awesome thing is that you don't even need a yard to support pollinators. Container gardening with native plants is super easy, and the combinations you can create are often surprising. The fact that some trees and shrubs do well in containers always astounds me. You can create container pockets of prairie to line your balcony. So container size depends on what you want to plant. Larger plants obviously need larger containers, but like drought-friendly glade plants do well in shallow containers with limestone gravel mixed in. And then you just want to water frequently so it doesn't dry out. And another cool thing, you can feel free to leave the entire container out over winter and the plants will come back next year.
Oh, that's great.
One fun idea is to combine different size containers next to each other and use complementary plant textures, such as a sedge, a fern, an iris, a big shrub, etc. There are endless combinations. One of my favorite combinations to put in a container is ostrich fern, downy wood mint, columbine, sedge, and heuchera. All the textures look so great together, and it's more of a formal look for, you can put it on your front patio. It's great. I also love rose verbena. It hangs over the edge of a container, and it blooms all year. We had some in containers this year that bloomed from May through December.
That's amazing, and I love the idea of creating that visual interest with textures. So let's say I have enough room for more than a container garden, but I'm concerned that my yard is still too small to really make a difference or contribute to the idea of a habitat quilt. What can I do to be the most effective in a small yard?
So as I mentioned, making sure your yard has flowers blooming year-round is crucial in supporting insects as their nutritional needs change with the season. Another way to be effective in a small yard is to have at least 3 species blooming every season. And again, in those small spaces, prioritize keystone native species that support a lot of other organisms. So for example, let's say I live in the city and I have this backyard with a huge magnolia tree and I'd like to have a native planting under it. I might plant a matrix of ground covers, including Pacra, Heuchera, and sedges. My favorite are Carex eburnea and Carex rosea.
And what are those in normal terms the rest of us can understand that are not horticulturists?
Yeah, so those are just a couple of really great low-growing sedges. Again, with there's so many sedges that are native to Missouri. You'll want to do some research for your site conditions. But yeah, so just plant a couple of those low-growing sedges mixed in with some woodland flowers like columbine, some dwarf crested iris, nice. Some phlox. And you'll have a really great naturalistic planting that you don't have to mow and that supports wildlife.
Okay, great. So it sounds like there are a lot of options and opportunities out there for everybody, no matter the size of their starting point. You know, whether you live in the city and your backyard is dominated by that large magnolia tree, or you live in the suburbs and maybe you need more formal plantings out front. It sounds like there's really something for everyone out there when it comes to ecological gardening and design. So I think that just about wraps up our talk for part 2 about designing an ecological garden. Thank you so much, Vivian, for talking us through how we get started with that. I know we could have talked about this for hours, but of course we're limited in time. That said, I think we've presented a number of jumping off points for listeners to start from if they care to dive deeper. What are some resources our listeners can tap into to learn more about ecological gardening design principles for their own gardens?
Shaw Nature Reserve has some great online guidebooks that I highly recommend. Grow Native is another organization that has great design examples and native species lists and tips for native landscaping. Their website is excellent. One of my favorite native landscape designers is Benjamin Vogt. He has an excellent social media presence and his website is super informational. Doug Tallamy, as we mentioned before, his books and his interviews are excellent for anyone beginning or any stage of your native landscaping process.
Awesome. And again, listeners, I will drop links for each of these resources into our show notes, so be sure and check those out. Vivian, thanks to you, I feel like our listeners have everything they need to get started designing a native garden that supports as many local wildlife species as possible. Thank you again for all your help with this topic, and I think that is a wrap for part 2 of Ecological Gardening 101. Okay, listeners, we'll be back with part 3 in just a couple of weeks, where we'll learn all about how to maintain our new native gardens and keep them looking great all year. In the meantime, as spring approaches, here's what's happening at Shaw Nature Reserve. Online registration is open for the Spring Into Nature 5K. This event takes place Saturday, March 23rd from 9 to noon and is open to adults and children 6 years of age and older. All participants will receive a native Missouri plant and a fashionable and trendy Spring Into Nature fanny pack. Again, registration is open online and we will link that in the show notes. And during our last episode, I reminded you to mark your calendars for the Spring Wildflower Market the first weekend of May. Grab that pen and paper. Here are a few more details. First, the online pre-sale opens April 10th at 9 a.m. at snrshop.org. Links in the show notes, as always. Second, the Wildflower Market itself will take place Friday, May 3rd and Saturday, May 4th. But please note, however, Friday is reserved for members of the Missouri Botanical Garden. Membership has lots of benefits all year long, so if you're interested in enjoying those, you can sign up to be a member online. And finally, spring and summer class registration is open too. Go online to browse our catalog and sign up. Check our show notes, our social media, and our website for more information. Thank you so much for listening. And from all of us at Shaw Nature Reserve, we hope to see you on the trail.